I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. According to our guest today, UNH professor and forest ecologist Scott Olinger, it was the Apollo missions into space that changed the way we think about our forests here on Earth. Before then, Olinger says, we had to climb a mountain or go up in an airplane in order to see the landscape. And even with that, you were limited to the horizons. But when we went up beyond the stratosphere, we got our first shots of the Earth. And from that, we began to see how significantly our forests were changing. Olinger has been working with NASA for about 15 years, and from that work, he's become very concerned about climate change, massive forest fires, the spread of invasive insects, and wild storms, all resulting in a 50% loss in forests in some parts of the globe. And there's even concern in a place like New Hampshire, which holds the significance of having more tree cover and the second highest amount of forest per square mile than any other state. Our woodlands are still facing serious challenges, which, if not addressed, could have dire effects on entire ecosystems here. Today in The Exchange, the fate of New Hampshire's forests with UNH professor and ecologist Scott Olinger. Olinger gave a talk last night on the history and future of forests as a cog in our Earth's systems as part of the Seacoast Science Cafe, and he sits down with us today. We want to hear from you as well this hour. What do you think are the major factors behind forest decline? And what can be done about it? What changes are you seeing in the forests around you? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Scott Olinger, it's been a while. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you very much, Laura. It's good to be here.
Well, let's get back to that NASA history, Scott. That's kind of cool. What did these early Apollo images from space show us that we'd really never seen before?
Well, I think this is a really interesting story that we've kind of forgotten about in our collective memory. Before the Apollo mission, there was this desire to show that technologically we could get to the moon and that the United States was had the ability to do these amazing things. And the Apollo mission really was, I think, one of the most amazing technological achievements that human beings have today still even ever achieved. But what's interesting is that as that mission was being planned, the whole focus was on the moon, getting to the moon, collecting rocks, what would it be like at the moon? And yet the most long-lasting legacy of that mission, I think, really had nothing to do with the moon. The moon turned out to be a very boring place. The really interesting part of it was that the astronauts, as they got further and further away from the Earth, eventually turned around and looked back. And that was the first time in the 10,000-year history of human civilization that anyone had ever seen what our planet looked like. And as you said in the introduction, prior to that, the biggest chunk of the ground we could see at any one time for some decades at least was from an airplane. And prior to that was the view from the top of the nearest hill you could climb. And so our psychological perception of the planet was very different. And it's been significantly altered by that image. At this point, we're awash in images of the Earth. We see the little icon of the planet on, eco-friendly products everywhere. And that's very nice. But in some way, it's had the effect of making us take for granted that we now know what the planet looks like.
Yeah, we forget what a wow moment that was.
Well, it was really a wow moment for the astronauts who came back and said the amazing thing was when they looked back, they didn't see political boundaries. They didn't see signs of the things that we spend our average workday concerned about. Instead, they saw cloud patterns. They saw ocean currents. They saw forest fires. And they just saw this amazing planet. And then they looked everywhere else around them. And in all other directions, there was deep, dark, the deep, dark void of space, which is about the most inhospitable environment you can possibly imagine. And they all came back profoundly altered by, wow, what a lucky planet we have. And that, I think, really, along with the globalization that we've seen take place both economically and culturally, that experience and what they brought back and the images that we have gained from that, I think, has really profoundly altered the way we interact with the environment.
Well, and I remember the first time I saw a picture of the planet with at night with the lights on. And you see, that was a wow moment for me. You know, you just see the entire East and West Coast, or just, and almost all of Europe, it looks like, you know, lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, that's another amazing image. And that's a good segue, I think, to one of the things that was another consequence of the Apollo mission. It was so successful for NASA, it was a hard act for them to follow. And they really had an identity crisis as an agency after Apollo. As amazing as that mission was, the public sentiment by the end of it was, well, that's really cool, but what good does that do us down here on Earth? And so the NASA agency had to do a little soul searching, and the next mission that they came up with, or one of the next missions, was called Mission to Planet Earth. And at that point, they decided that they would use their ability to work in the space environment, to build and launch satellites, to focus here at home and to focus on what was going on in terms of changes in our landscape and changes in our ecosystem. Well, I think they've done a bad job of marketing that, because we still think of them as the space agency, but they do a lot of work in terms of understanding our planet and looking at how it's changing.
Well, and your specialty is forestry, so let's get into that then,
sure.
Scott. So what did these awesome images from space tell us for the first time about our forests here on Earth?
Well, one of the things that the images have showed us really is the extent of forests. We can now see seasonally how they green up and brown down in different parts of the world. We can see how climate in different regions affects the greening and browning of forests, that we can track the seasonality, whether spring is coming earlier or fall is happening later. We can see that over much larger areas with satellites than we could if we were just making observations from the ground. We've also learned that forests play a very critical role in regulating the Earth's climate. We used to think, well, you know, forests will be affected by climate change and forests respond to climate. We now know that forests are actually architects of our Earth's climate. They really regulate what the atmosphere is composed of. They regulate the formation of clouds. They regulate how much water vapor is in the air. They really play a critical role in maintaining the kind of climate that we have, you know, come to, as humans, adapt to.
Wow, that's really interesting. So they're not just passive actors that the climate acts upon. They are active players.
Exactly. And that's a real critical point. And it becomes more critical when you then start looking at what we have learned from looking at forests and with a global perspective for the last couple of decades. I've been working in forests in New Hampshire, but also in other parts of North America. I have visited forests in South America and Asia and Australia. And one of the things that's really striking that isn't apparent when we live here in New Hampshire, where our forests are by and large healthy and thriving, over the course of people manipulating and clearing land, the planet has lost about 50% of its original forest cover.
Okay, that's huge.
A lot. It's not a small amount. So when you think about the role forests play in regulating climate, and then you remove 50% of that landscape, it's hard to imagine that won't have some kind of a consequence.
I have to jump in and ask you a specific question. When you say 50%, the planet has lost 50% of its original forest cover, how do you measure original? I mean, is that the dinosaurs? Is it post-Ice Age? I mean, how do you even begin to find that first data point from which you pull out that 50% number?
That's an excellent question. And the 50% number really is an approximate. And we have to go back and look at things like pollen records. We have to look at the climate history. And I really am, when I use that number, I'm talking about after the last Ice Age. And we think of deforestation as a modern-day phenomenon, and it's accelerated recently, but it's really been going on for as long as human civilization has been, on the planet. We learn in high school that the birthplace of civilization was near the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That's modern-day Iraq. We see that landscape on the news all the time. It doesn't look like an environment that would support the birthplace of civilization. The reason is it was deforested many, many years ago, and the effect that had on precipitation patterns and climate has caused an expansion of the deserts in the Middle East. It's not the only factor, but it's an important factor.
Wow. Well, and we hear about massive floods in Southeast Asia and so forth, due partly because there aren't the forests that used to be there to catch the water as it
exactly.
should be caught.
Exactly.
Let me jump in for just a second, Scott, and invite our listeners to join us. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're examining the health of our forests through the health of our trees. And we've long heard that New Hampshire is the second most forested state in the country. But even our forests face serious challenges. We'll be be looking at that in just a moment. Right now, we're getting a global picture from Scott Olinger, professor of natural resources and the environment at UNH. We'd love to hear from you this hour, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. What do you think are the major factors behind forest decline here in the Granite State? What do you think could be done about it? What are you seeing around you in terms of the health of our forests? Give us a call. The exchange number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And you were talking a moment ago, Scott, about that global picture and what we've learned and the impact that forests play in climate. Again, you said they're not just passive beings or passive entities, they're actors. Give us just a tiny bit more on that, if you could. You started to go there, but I'd love to hear more how forests play a role in what our climate will be.
Well, here's one example. Climate change is something that we've been talking about for a long time. And climate change is a really interesting topic. And the public discussion on climate change, I think, has gotten much more complicated and probably obfuscated than it should. What climate change is driven by is the fact that human beings every year release to the atmosphere, I'll put this in layman's terms, release to the atmosphere something like 16 trillion pounds of carbon. That's a lot of carbon. If you were to put that in blocks of charcoal and stack them in your backyard, it would be a huge, huge, huge pile of carbon. That's what we're doing to the atmosphere through fossil fuel combustion. We know that CO2, that carbon dioxide, has insulating properties. It traps heat. The result of this emission is about a 30% increase so far in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Regardless of the nitty-gritty details about climate change, it's very difficult to imagine that you could take an important constituent of the atmosphere, raise it by 30%, and expect nothing to happen. That's where I come from.
So the trees, how much of this carbon do they suck up, right? Because we always hear that trees are good at that.
Well, exactly. And so if you try to estimate how much carbon is stored in trees globally, there's actually more carbon in ecosystems than there is in the atmosphere. So as we remove forests through land clearing, we're adding to that emission of carbon to the atmosphere. But as you say, the forests that are still healthy and are still thriving, that's what they do for a living. They take carbon and they build wood and leaves and things like that. So if the amount of carbon that trees take up globally to use, the units that I just used is something like 4 to 5 trillion pounds per year. So they're taking up a lot of what we are releasing, which is doing us quite a large favor that we don't always appreciate them for.
All right. A lot more after a short break. Stay right here.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More of The Exchange coming up in a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the implications of a pilot shortage in the United States. NHPR is more than our daily broadcast. Check out our website to listen back to a story you might have missed or only caught a part of. Find more information or related stories about something that interests you. Subscribe to podcasts. Learn about special events. There's always something more at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Trust for Public Land, conserving parks, trails, and forests for people to enjoy since 1972. Information at tpl.org. From the Joslin Diabetes Center affiliated Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, offering comprehensive diabetes care to patients across southeastern New Hampshire, frisbeehospital.com. And Hypertherm, an associate-owned manufacturer of metal-cutting equipment made in New Hampshire and sold worldwide, hypertherm.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the health of our trees and our forests here in New Hampshire, but also globally. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. Scott Olinger is here, professor of natural resources at UNH. He gave a discussion about the past and future of our forests as part of the Seacoast Science Cafe series last night. Our number for you to join us today is 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Scott, let's go right to our callers. And Wade is calling in from Hillsborough. Hi, Wade. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Laura. I have a question for Scott about reforestation. With all the crazy weather we've been having, we've had farmers on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers flooded out of their farms, and people losing their homes in these areas where they never should have built or farmed in the first place. And I wonder if any of the big environmental groups, like the Wilderness Society or anything like that, are actively buying up the areas where people shouldn't really rebuild and reforesting them and basically creating new parks and wild areas. Is anyone trying to do that?
Thanks a lot for the call, Wade. What do you think, Scott?
Well, it's a great question. I think there's a lot of good incentive to do that. I don't work with those groups directly, so I don't actually know if there are plans to actively buy up land and engage in reforestation efforts. I know that in some places, at local levels with local municipalities and also state, and in some cases the federal government, there are efforts to reforest some areas that have been cleared. There also is an effort in some places to reforest land that was cleared for agriculture that's no longer really productive for agriculture. And as far as the areas, in the Midwest that Wade referred to, I'm not actually sure, but it's a great idea. And as you mentioned earlier, Laura, forests do have an ability to dampen the effects of heavy rainfall by, kind of decreasing the rate of runoff by having more water absorbed into soil. So they can play that role of helping us prevent some of the flooding events that we've seen from increases in severe storms. But as far as Wade's question, I don't actually know. That's a great thing to look into.
Well, it could be an expensive proposition because you would have to buy the land and then plant the trees and so forth. You can't just take somebody's farm and say, this isn't working and we're going to plant trees here now.
Well, that's true. But, one of the things that I think is critical if we want to preserve landscapes that have trees in them is we have to somehow or another figure out how to make it economically viable to have forested landscapes. And there are a number of ways of doing that. One is by having a healthy forest products industry. And in New Hampshire, we've, benefited by having forests that have provided a lot of economic benefits to the state for a long time. But there also are, potential benefits through things like carbon trading markets of reforestation. If it's a large enough area and you can demonstrate that you have the proper kind of forest management in place, it is possible in some parts of the country to actually get paid to grow forest.
Well, there's another economic element to forests as well. I mean, people come to New Hampshire to hike in the woods, so.
Well, that's right. So if you add up, I think, and I'm not an economist, but if you add up the effects of forests on New Hampshire's economy, from what I know from the resource economists at UNH, something like 25% of the state's gross revenue stream can in some way or another be tied to the natural resource base we have. So even on those grounds, it's worth making sure that we maintain a healthy landscape covered with forests.
Yeah, it's interesting, too. You see how much the knowledge has come along. You talked about the trees stopping runoff and stopping flooding. In some cities and towns in New Hampshire, the mills grew up alongside the rivers because the rivers help power the mills. And that means in some parts of New Hampshire, I'm talking about Manchester, I'm talking about Concord, especially, you don't have trees by the river.
Well, that's right.
Parts of the river.
That's right. And, one of the consequences back when those old mills were being built, there was a very heavy wave of deforestation that came through the whole northeastern United States from the mid-1800s to the early 1900s. It really was the result of the railroads. Once the railroads came in, it was possible to move large volumes of wood from the North Country down to where the markets were. Before that, with horses and ox, you couldn't really, move that volume of wood. So once the railroads came in, there was this very heavy wave of deforestation. And ironically, they used to use the rivers to run logs in some cases, in addition to the rail lines. And one of the consequences of removing trees along the river basins was erosion that in some cases filled up the rivers and streams with sediment, which increased the flood risk, but also made those rivers less viable for moving logs, which was, what their intention was in the first place.
So wow.
Kind of backfired on them, but they really didn't have the information at that point that we do today to know not to do that.
Well, Wade, thanks for the call. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. To Brookline next, Ben is on the air. Welcome, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Actually, my comment was really along those same lines prior to the Industrial Revolution. If you take a hike through the woods, mostly throughout southern New Hampshire, what you find is a lot of stone walls where farming fields were. Trees have been cut down, burned down, hauled out. But over the course of the last 100 years, what you see is a real big bounce back in a young forest in New Hampshire.
Right.
And it's one of those things that, it's possible. And how can we apply, you know, what happened in our own economic changeover from prior to the Industrial Revolution to present to get other communities and other areas of the world reforested somewhat in the same way that's happened here.
You know, Ben, that is a great question because he's absolutely right. As you were saying, Scott, we've been here before where deforestation was an enormous problem in New Hampshire. You look at the pictures from the White Mountains, you know, 150 years ago, and it looks like a moonscape practically. So Ben's question, what can we learn from our success in reforesting New Hampshire and apply it to ourselves today, to the rest of the world today? It's a great question, Ben.
Yeah, and I think there are probably a few things that we can learn. One, we've learned how fortunate we are to live in a region where we have climate and soils that make forests very resilient. There are parts of the world where the forests would not have recovered from the kinds of disturbances that happened here. It's absolutely true. Back in the 1800s, the New England landscape was largely devoid of trees over. You know, large areas that were either deforested for logging or for farming. And now you drive around and walk through the woods and there are healthy, thriving forests. We've been surprised, those of us that do research on forest regrowth have been surprised at the ability of forests to gain access to things like soil nutrients that they couldn't actually, we didn't think they had access to. Forests in some places have fungi that they associate with that can literally dissolve rocks that go down into the soil and break up mineral materials so that they can get the nutrients they need to regrow, and that's been very interesting. We're really lucky to have those kinds of forests here in New England. Something that I think is interesting, though, and worth mentioning is over the last 100 years, the general trend has been an increase in forest cover. But over the last several decades, even in New Hampshire, that trend has been reversed. So now we're actually seeing a net loss of forest from year to year in New Hampshire and across most of New England, rather than a net gain.
So back up and say that again, Scott, because that's an important point. So measuring from, say, 150 years ago, we, meaning the world, are doing better in terms of regenerating our forests. But then you sort of see an apex, what, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, yeah, I would actually say that
that's
world,
the best of times, and now it's getting worse.
I would say that the world is not doing a better job. Globally, the trend has been a decline, you know, all along. In the Northeast, our history is a little bit different. We had this wave of land clearing back in the, you know, from the 17 to early 1900s. Once agriculture moved west after Lewis and Clark, you know, had their famous voyage, we saw a lot of the agricultural land abandoned and forests, you know, really did recover and have grown back up in most of those landscapes. What we have been seeing in New Hampshire in the last couple of decades is a decline rather than an increase, and it's been driven not by agriculture or by logging so much as simply by development, by the fact that the state's population is growing, and the way that we develop the landscape, the kinds of housing lots we build, the kinds of single-family dwellings in, you know, what we call ex-urban landscapes in some cases, has led at this point to a decline in forest cover. Forest cover in New Hampshire peaked probably somewhere in the 1980s in terms of the amount of the state's land that was covered with forest.
Yeah, that's when we entered a period of massive growth, 80s and 90s. Foresters talked a lot about fragmentation, how forests were broken up into little chunks. You said something that just needs to be clarified, though, because it's been in the news lately, Scott. Tree cover versus forest cover. It came out recently that New Hampshire had the most amount of tree cover. I may not be saying it right, but that's not the same as being the most forested.
Yeah, no.
Why does that matter?
Well, I think you are saying it right. I'm not sure it matters enough to make that big a deal of. But in terms of being first in the having the most tree cover in the country, I think a lot of people in New Hampshire grabbed onto that and really liked the idea of being first. But the difference between forest cover and tree cover, we have a lot of suburban landscapes that have, you know, lawns and parks and things like that that also have trees in them. So that you could call a fraction of that landscape covered by trees, but I wouldn't call it a forest if it doesn't have a traditional forest soil, if it doesn't cycle nutrients and really behave like a forest, if it's not an intact, continuous block of tree cover, then we don't really classify it as a forest. We classify it as a suburban or some other kind of landscape. And those landscapes went into that calculation of, I think the number was 89% tree
yes.
cover, which puts us slightly ahead of Maine in terms of tree cover. Maine still has more forests. They have more land that's still in industrial forestry. So after a swath of land is cleared for tree harvesting, that's temporarily not tree cover any longer. It's now, you know, bare soil. So if you look at the landscape with a satellite, for example, you might not consider that tree cover, but still technically it's a forest because it will be regenerating trees. It will retain the functions that the soils bring and so on and so forth. So there really is a difference.
So from an ecological perspective, from a climate perspective, tree cover is not as good as forest cover.
Well, I always hate to say good or bad, but yeah, I guess you could say that. But trees are still good. You know, if we have – we need – I'm not meaning to beat up suburban landscapes. I live in a suburban landscape myself, and we all need suburban landscapes. And in suburban as well as urban landscapes, we also need trees. Trees serve a very useful role wherever they are, whether it's in something that we would classify a forest or an urban landscape. An urban landscape without trees would be a much kind of less healthy landscape than an urban landscape with trees. But there is a difference in terms of the services that they provide to us between tree cover and forest cover. Water quality is probably one of the greatest services that forest soils provide to us. Forest soils are terrific water filters. We really benefit by having clean aquifers in New Hampshire. But when you start having an increase in the spread of lawns and impermeable surfaces, you lose that. You lose that water filtration effect.
Now, that's been a big debate in the Shoreland Protection Act here in New Hampshire. People who buy on the waterfront want that nice view, and yet when they cut down the trees, they are sometimes, in fact, hurting the water quality because there's less of a root system to filter out the stormwater before it gets into the water body.
That's right. Yeah, there's less of a root system. And also, through no fault of grasses, I think grasses are nice also. But lawns tend to, and even native grasslands, tend to have soils that have higher pH. And higher pH tends to do things like promote nitrogen being converted to nitrate, which can then leach down and find its way into our freshwater systems. And that's become a problem in some areas. I live near Great Bay, and there's a real nitrogen over-fertilization problem in Great Bay right now. And that's largely because of the development and the conversion of native forest to more human-dominated landscapes in that watershed.
All right, let's take some more calls, Scott. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Join us. We're looking at the health of our forests, both globally and more recently here in New Hampshire. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Scott Olinger, Professor of Natural Resources and the Environment at UNH. Give us a call. Tell us what you think about the factors behind forest decline here in the Granite State, what might be done about it, also just what you're noticing in terms of the forests near you. And let's go to Stratum next. Roger's waiting there. Hi, Roger. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Laura. Yeah, I've been on the local land protection committee in Stratum for 10 years, and I've seen some changes. We passed a $5 million bond to prevent that conversion that Scott was talking about, and we did it because of the promise of LCHIP. Now, while we never took advantage of LCHIP, the town did pass a bond, and in the last conservation easement we closed upon inspection of the property, we had to notify the landowner of the woolly adelgid. So I'd like to ask about the prospects of New Hampshire's hemlocks and the woolly adelgid over time. The other change we've seen in Stratum and elsewhere going up 101 back and forth is the preponderance of the Japanese knotweed. And what your guest feels is a consequence of an invasive species like Japanese knotweed.
Wow, great questions, Roger, and ones that we could probably fill a whole hour with, Scott. But, boy, those are two good ones. There's a lot of concern about the woolly adelgid.
Yeah, there is. And actually, one of the things that, if I can back up to some of the concerns we have about forests globally, the four things I would say are concerns globally are development, invasive species that are, being moved around the planet by humans, illegal logging, and climate change. And of those four major concerns, in New Hampshire, I think we have three of them. Illegal logging isn't a big deal, but development, invasive species, and climate change are all things we're very concerned about. And the hemlock woolly adelgid is a great example of an interaction, really, between climate change and invasive species. It's an insect pest. It's been in the U.S. since the 1950s. It was introduced much further south from here, down, I think, in Virginia. And it has been spreading northward over the years and killing large swaths of hemlock in its path. It arrived in New Hampshire, in southern New Hampshire, Hampshire and southern Maine about 10 years ago, and then it stalled out. It really hasn't continued to spread northward at the rate that it had been, partly because of our cold winters here. It doesn't like cold winters. However, there's the interaction with climate change. As we see, you know, more and more winters that aren't our traditional really cold winters, the woolly adelgid is having a chance to kind of reinvigorate itself, and it can overwinter now, and it's starting its northward spread again.
It can overwinter, meaning it can survive over the winter if it doesn't get super, super cold?
That's right, yeah. So temperatures below, I think there's a critical temperature of something like minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit that tends to just kill them. They're small little insects, and they're not well insulated, so when it gets that cold, they just the overwintering eggs die. And so if we have temperatures that are that cold in the winter at some point, then we don't see that northward spread of the adelgid. But as the winter climate warms up, I think we can expect to see the adelgid, you know, continuing to move north and continuing to be a problem for hemlocks.
And so what does that mean? No more hemlocks after a certain point in time?
Conceivably, yes. And that's happened in the past. There have been, in the early 1900s, there was the chestnut blight. You know, we forget that American chestnut used to be one of the predominant species of trees in the eastern United States, and it's now almost completely gone. There are still chestnuts, but they really don't live beyond the sapling stage before they get hit with this disease and die. So we've lost the chestnut. The hemlock conceivably could be lost, probably at some point further north. You know, even under extreme climate change scenarios, there may be pockets of hemlock that can hang on. But over time, it's not looking good for hemlock.
And, you know, not to sound, I don't know, crass or coarse or uncaring, but, you know, beyond, gee, it's too bad we don't have hemlocks, why does this really matter?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Hemlock itself, if we wanted to talk about that species, has a number of important roles that it plays in our ecosystems for wildlife habitat, for water quality, et cetera. It's a late successional species. There are a lot of things that make hemlock unique. However, I understand that point, but I would probably step back and look at the spread of invasive insects more broadly. In addition to the hemlock woolly adelgid, we also have the Asian longhorn beetle, which is, in my mind, more of a concern because it's not a species-specific insect. It likes a lot of different hardwood species. Its favorite is maple, and this is an insect that bores into the bark, and the larvae basically, you know, bore tunnels underneath the bark of the tree and eventually kill the tree. There was an outbreak around Worcester, Massachusetts, a few years ago that led to some action taken by that city to cut down all of the maples in a certain area to make sure that.
Oh, what a shame! Wow.
Well, yeah, but you know, it would be devastating if this thing really spread. And it's almost, I hate to sound grim, but it's hard to imagine that at some point it won't start popping up in other locations.
All right. Lots more to talk about after a short break, and we'll take more of your calls. So join us at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Comcast Business Class, provider of internet, voice, TV, and Ethernet solutions that keep pace with the growth of your business. More information at 800-501-6000. And from Rotary, providing community service to Vermont, New Hampshire, and the world. Rotary, humanity in motion. Information at rotary7870.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
It is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
Daniel Day-Lewis has Abraham Lincoln in the new Steven Spielberg film. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tony Kushner, who spent years writing the screenplay for Lincoln. He also won a Pulitzer for his play, Angels in America. Join us.
Fresh Air, this afternoon at 3 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, facing off over the fiscal cliff, we'll look at the debate on Capitol Hill and what's being proposed to avoid some of the worst-case scenarios. Email us your questions and thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're examining the health of our forests through our trees. Our guest is Scott Olinger, professor of natural resources and the environment. and Associate Director of the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at UNH. He recently spoke on this topic as part of the Seacoast Science Cafe series. The number for you to join us this hour is 1-800-892-6477. What questions or observations do you have about the health of New Hampshire's forests? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Scott, one more question before we go back to our listeners. You talked just before the break about the hemlock, woolly adelgid, the Asian long-horned beetle. Very concerned about those. It could potentially, worst case scenario, wipe out our forests. And you link those to climate change, since these are species that would be killed off if we had colder winters. So here's the question for you. Beyond stopping climate change right in its tracks, right now, today, which seems unlikely, what do you do about these invasive insects that really have the ability to decimate our forests?
Well, that's the million-dollar question right now. It's really difficult. Once invasive insects make it to the, you know, to our ecosystems, it's really difficult to stop them. But we certainly need to try. I think, you know, probably there are education campaigns that are underway to try to educate the public about what these insects look like in case they show up in your backyard and you can identify them and report to the local Forest Service office or something that you've seen this. Another thing is to, with respect to the Asian longhorn beetle, to make sure that we don't transport firewood from one location to the other, because that's often how these things spread. There's a larvae bored into the wood. We cut down trees and we bring firewood camping with us, and that's a real source of concern. And then at the national scale, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has the responsibility basically of monitoring our ports so that when products come in from Asia and other parts of the world, they're often stacked on wood shipping crates. And the Asian longhorn beetle, for example, came in with wood shipping crates. And it's really difficult. Imagine the amount of commerce that's going on globally. How the heck do we inspect every wood shipping crate that comes in? It's very difficult. I actually think we need to be spending a lot more attention on this problem. I think invasive insects, in over the next 50 years, is probably one of the biggest factors that could potentially alter the forests we have.
Let's take another call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Jerry's calling in from Newcastle. Hi, Jerry, you're on the Exchange. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks, Laura, very much. Changing subjects entirely, I wanted to talk about what we used to call forest fires, we now call wildfires. It's a big issue in the West, the Southwest, and the Southeast. It's actually been a big issue here. One time we had a forest fire in the late 40s that went from the White Mountains all the way to the ocean in Maine. So we've had some very large fires. And there appear to be two camps. One is to let them burn themselves out, and the other one is put it out before it goes 10 yards so we can protect all the people that have built their houses in the forest or on the forest, what some people call the urban-forest interface. I guess I have two questions. What do you think about how we handle forest fires, and how does the forest start to recover once it's happened?
You know, this is a question, Jerry, right? And I'm sure you know this. You too, Scott. This is something that we have gone back and forth on. The latest research showing forest fires are good, and we shouldn't move so quickly to put them out.
Yeah, well, we've certainly learned a lot about that. In the early 1900s, the U.S. Forest Service had a policy of putting out forest fires, and the intention was to protect the timber resource of the country. What we've learned from years of A, making that mistake, and B, research that we've done, is that if you continue to put fires out when they start, you end up with an accumulation of dead wood, which creates a lot of fuel. So eventually, if a fire does break out that you can't control, it's a much bigger fire normally happen. So that, through trial and error, a lot of error, we've learned that in some cases it is better to let fires burn and maybe even use fire. The Forest Service uses fire as a management tool. If fires don't break out on their own, we actually go in and, burn parts of the landscape just to reduce that fire fuel load. But there also is this balance, because as we have development, as we have people moving into forested landscapes, you can't simply just let wildfires burn everywhere because there are people living in these landscapes. And that's a really difficult balance to try to strike. I'm glad I don't have to make decisions on which fires to put out and which fires not to, because there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with having to make those decisions.
Yeah, and this has been a big issue out west especially. Is this really an issue that we deal with in New England? I can appreciate the dilemma out west. You know, we need to burn part of this forest to keep it healthy, but there's a housing development right next door. But do we deal with that very much in New England or not?
Yes, we do. You know, what we think of as the northern hardwood forest in places like the White Mountains, those don't have fire as a natural disturbance mechanism very often. There were a lot of fires after the logging that I mentioned because there was a lot of debris left behind on the ground. There were some huge fires in the early 1900s. But we also have forests in New England that grow on very sandy soils. We have something called pitch pine. There are the pine barrens near Madison, New Hampshire. There's pitch pine along the sand plains in southern Maine. And those are areas where fire is more of a naturally occurring phenomenon. You know, the fire that Jerry mentioned in the 1940s was really burned to the greatest extent in areas of southern coastal Maine, which are on those kinds of sandy soils. There's still a lot of pitch pine in that area today. We also potentially could see, depending on what changes in climate take place in the future, we're expecting more precipitation in the future, but more of that precipitation coming as rain and in the winter with longer and drier summers. So it's conceivable that we could start having to deal more with fires in the east. In the West, just to add one thing, all of these things are related. And another insect that the Western forest has been dealing with is something called the mountain pine beetle, which has killed huge tracts of land covered with lodgepole pine. And there have been some very large fires that have broken out after some of those insect outbreaks, the pine beetle outbreaks in the West, because of the fuel from all of those newly killed trees.
Let's take another call. Thanks for that one. And let's go next to Jason in Concord. Hi, Jason. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Yeah, this is Jason Stock. I'm with the New Hampshire Timberland Owners Association, and we represent, our members represent about over a million acres in the state of New Hampshire. And I guess a comment and then a quick question. We don't believe that it is quite as dire as your guest has. I mean, when you talk about deforestation, I mean, yes, our forests have threats, and they always have. But, you know, we have 84% of the state covered in forest, whereas 100 years ago it was less than half. And our trees are getting older, and we're seeing more growth and removal statewide. And yeah, there are some threats, such as invasive species and development, but I guess, you know, my comment is that it's not as nearly as bad as I think some folks would profess in terms of the condition of our forest, although there's always room for improvement. And here's my question is, you know, education seems to be a big part of this, educating landowners and the public about things like invasive species, how to better manage your forest. And I guess I'm curious what your guest believes would be some effective tools or effective ways to accomplish that, to educate folks about not only forest values, but also some of these new threats that we do see out there, such as Asian longhorn beetle and woolly adelgid.
And Jason, I'm glad you called again since you're with the New Hampshire Timberland Owners. Quick question for you. Scott listed the top four concerns he has about forests globally: development, invasive species, illegal logging, which again we don't really have here, and climate change. Among your membership, what would they put at the top? Development, invasive species, climate change, all of the above?
Our members, the biggest threat that we see to keeping and growing trees is just the financial aspect of it, being able to afford to, having good markets for forest products, having good tax policy, and that doesn't force people to have to sell property. And, you know, that at the end of the day, having a good financial an economic framework to grow and manage timberland is really, we believe, and our members do, that's really the name of the game. If we can afford to own land and grow trees, people will. But when you have taxes and you have markets that are on a roller coaster, it gets very difficult to
and global competition and
exactly.
all that.
Yeah.
Jason, hang on if you could. Scott, he asked about public education, and that's right up your alley. Again, you did this Science Cafe discussion last night on the Seacoast.
Yeah, and I'm actually glad, Jason, thanks for that. And one thing I should say is if I painted a picture of New Hampshire's forests being dire, I didn't mean to. I think New Hampshire's forests are really a good model for what the rest of the world, what would be nice if the rest of the world looked like. The reason I think about this is I've been working in a lot of other parts of the world, and I'm looking at the trends going on elsewhere on the planet. And I don't think the picture would look quite so rosy if we were, you know, down in the Amazon rainforests of Brazil or in some of the areas in Asia where we don't have 84% of the landscape covered with forests and we don't have, you know, timber markets and we don't have the kinds of things that we have here. So the reason that I'm becoming more concerned and more interested in working in our forests locally is these patterns, these things that are happening in other parts of the world, we're not going to be shielded from them. Indefinitely. There are signs that these things could actually affect us. A lot of these invasive insects are at our doorstep, and I think they are potentially important. Climate change is something we probably won't see the effects of. We're starting to see some effects in subtle ways, but that's something that takes a long time to transpire. So I'm more of the perspective that we have really nice and very healthy landscapes now, but we really should appreciate them perhaps more than we do and make sure that we take action to protect them. And I couldn't agree more that having viable markets for forested land is part of that, because if there isn't a good financial incentive to maintain, you know, large blocks of timberland, then we'll continue to see them fragmented and we'll continue to see a loss of forest cover. So I actually agree completely with what Jason said.
Well, and he talked about public education. I'd love to ask you, Scott, who among the public needs to be educated? I mean, sure, all of us, but, you know, land use decision makers, for example, planning and zoning boards, developers. I mean, who really needs to, in your opinion, get up to speed on the role that forests play in terms of water quality, air quality, and even the big kahuna, climate change?
Yeah. Well, I think all of the stakeholders that you just mentioned, and probably with an emphasis on private landowners, because most of the land in the Northeast that is forested is in the hands of private landowners. And, you know, they know the woods that they've got and they know, you know, what's there. And even in some cases, a lot about what the history of those woodlands are. But, you know, depending on the reasons that people own land, depending on their history, depending on their perspectives and interests, not all of them have their own management plan. Not all of them have a real sense of what they want that landscape to look like in the future. So I think private landowners are probably a really good place to start. And, you know, Jason is in a much better position to comment on that in some ways than I am. But sometimes we refer to private land ownership as, I don't want to say the wildfire of the East, but something like that. It's what the decisions that people who own forest land make has the equivalent effect on our landscape in terms of shaping what its forests look like as a natural disturbance out in the West would.
Even when people understand these impacts that you're talking about, again, water quality, air quality, climate change, and so forth, you know, there's the competing desire. A town or a city wants to build a new road. They feel like it's important to make traffic flow through the city better or whatever. 9 times out of 10, even if they understand, they say, yeah, but we need the road and it's not that much forest, and so let's just build it. I mean, it seems like 9 times out of 10, the road is built.
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert on planning by any stretch, so I probably am not a great person to comment on this. But I do know just from looking at, say, the last 30 years of data from the Landsat satellite, looking at how the New Hampshire landscape has changed over that time period, most of the forest loss to development happens along roadways. So we really need, if we are building new roadways, we need to keep in mind that those new corridors for human, you know, transportation will likely be the areas where we see, you know, increases in fragmentation into the future. Certainly we need development, we need landscapes, we need shopping malls, and we need homes to live in. But there are decisions that we can make in terms of if we have, say, what's our target? Let's say we want to limit the amount of development so that ultimately we maintain New Hampshire at, say, 70% forest cover. We're now at 84, and that's declining. You know, what's our target? What's our goal? If we have something like 70% forest cover, there are different ways of doing that. You can have 70% cover in lots of little chunks, or you can have 70% forest cover with much larger parcels where there are corridors for wildlife and where there are larger chunks, which are easier and more economically, I think, viable to manage as timberland. So those are the kind of decisions to make.
And more ecologically useful.
That's right. Yeah.
As you said earlier.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. How to achieve that, I'm probably not the person to comment on that. Jason would be a better person to comment on that than I would.
Well, it's a political decision, too, at some point. Yeah. Well, here's an email from Charles in Enfield. It's a real interesting question, and I'll throw it at you, Scott. He says, my understanding is that our forest evolved along with Native Americans' burning regime. Charles asks, what are the chances of returning our forest landscape to pre-Columbian conditions? Wow, 500 years ago.
That's a great question. I love that question. Yeah, well, you know, this is interesting because when we are managing forests, we have to think about, well, what is it that we ultimately want them to look like? And, I'm not the person to dictate what New Hampshire's forest should look like, but we often think about what the pristine forest of New Hampshire would have looked like before Europeans came. But the reality is that there have been humans in New England for, 6 to 8,000 years. And Charles is right. The Native Americans weren't passive members of the landscape. They knew what they were doing, and they used, forest management tools. And fire was a very useful one. Fire is a very useful way of manipulating the landscape. Some of the earliest reports of what this landscape looked like from Europeans in the 1500s was that when they arrived at the seacoast, they had to walk several miles inland before they actually saw large tract of forest land.
Really? So yeah, a lot of that was burned.
That's right. A lot of it was burned and converted to grassland, agriculture land. That's true along the seacoast and also along the major river valleys, not so much in the interior parts of the state.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about. Scott, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
That's Scott Olinger, Professor of Natural Resources and the Environment and Associate Director of the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at UNH. As I said, he recently spoke on the topic of trees as part of the Seacoast Science Cafe series. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.